Hello there. Today is Monday, March 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, what's ahead for the president's agenda following last week's failed health care vote?
There is some question as to whether Republicans will be able to unite on much of anything.
A not-so-pleasant two-year anniversary in the Middle East, and protesters take to the streets in Moscow, hundreds arrested. Also ahead,
we can remind ourselves to really wake up your soul. Do what you love.
An American couple making music with a message. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the Trump legislative agenda took a big hit last week as a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, often called Obamacare, was pulled before members of the House of Representatives could vote. Sunday, the president, in a tweet, shifted the blame, saying, quote, "Democrats are smiling that the Freedom Caucus, with the help of the Club for Growth and Heritage, have saved Planned Parenthood and O-Care, Obamacare." Meanwhile, some questions remain about support in the Senate for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman briefs VOA's Jim Stevenson on where Republicans and the White House stand heading into the new week.
Jim, as a result of things that happened last week, there is real question in Washington whether Republicans, despite having control of the White House and both houses of Congress, have an actual working majority. And this came into focus when the Republicans' long-promised bill to repeal and replace Obamacare essentially crashed and burned when it became apparent that there were not enough Republican votes to get it through the House of Representatives. And this has thrown a wrench into President Trump's nascent agenda. There is some question as to whether Republicans will be able to unite on much of anything when it comes to tax reform or perhaps infrastructure. And on the Senate side, you do have President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, completing the hearings, apparently not making any major gaffes, but also not winning over any Democrats. And there is some question as to whether Neil Gorsuch will be confirmed through the regular process, whether Democrats will filibuster, and if so, what would be the Republicans' next move?
It would seem the path to the Supreme Court nominee is smoother than the path to any legislative success for the White House.
I would say so, although Democrats are making an interesting argument. They are making the argument that amid so much chaos surrounding the White House, whether it's the Obamacare replacement going down in flames, whether it is this continuing investigation into Russian meddling and any possible contacts between Russia and those close to Donald Trump, Democrats are arguing that this casts a shadow over the entire Trump presidency and that maybe we should wait on confirming his Supreme Court nominee until we see how this investigation plays out. I don't think Republicans are going to go for that argument, but Democrats are going to be making a lot of noise when it comes to Neil Gorsuch. The progressive activists are exerting an enormous amount of pressure on them, and it may come down to whether or not Republicans are willing to trigger what's called the nuclear option, which is to say, fine, Democrats aren't going to give us the 8 votes that would be needed to overcome a filibuster, a 3/5 vote. So therefore, we are going to change the Senate rules and eliminate the filibuster and confirm him with a simple majority vote. That would be a striking and unprecedented move, but it's one where if Democrats are simply obstructing everything, they may feel compelled to take that step.
And this, quote, nuclear option is something the Democrats initially had put in place.
You know, Democrats may regret what they did just a couple of years ago when Republicans were filibustering almost all of former President Barack Obama's nominees for lower court positions, for positions within his administration. And in a fit of pique, Democrats said, fine, we're going to change the rules and eliminate the filibuster for all positions except Supreme Court nominees. From there, it's a relatively short step for Republicans to use that same logic and say, well, Democrats cast the first stone. We're going to complete the process that they started. There are a number of Republicans who you might say are sort of traditionalists and who believe in the Senate being a unique institution where things are supposed to slow down. The purpose of the filibuster is to ensure fulsome debate. Mm. That debate is not cut off. There are those Republicans and Democrats who believe that the Senate should not essentially become just like the House of Representatives. However, there are political pressures involved, and I see no Republican who believes that Neil Gorsuch should not be on the Supreme Court and that Donald Trump should not have the right to name the successor to Antonin Scalia.
Well, here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Russian police arrest an opposition leader at a Moscow protest. German Chancellor's center-right party to win the state election, according to exit polls. The Jewish American lobby opens a conference in Washington. Donald Trump will sign an executive order undoing Obama cuts in power plant emissions. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Tens of thousands of Russians demonstrated in cities across the country in support of a call by Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny for accountability among Russia's elite. Hundreds of people were detained, including Navalny, for protesting without permission. Navalny, who has announced plans to run for president in the 2018 election, is a strong Kremlin critic. Reports from the scene say police put him in a truck that was surrounded by hundreds of protesters who tried to open its doors and halt the arrest. Meanwhile, U.S. Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, a ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, which has been looking into Russia's interference in the U.S. presidential election, is expressing his grave concerns about Russia's influence around the world.
I think people need to understand we are in a global war of ideas. It's not communism versus capitalism, but it is authoritarianism versus democracy. And Putin is very much at the vanguard of that autocratic movement, and that ought to concern all of us.
The U.S. State Department has strongly condemned the detention of those protesters throughout Russia. The United Nations on Monday will begin negotiations on a legally binding treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. This comes as the United States begins a review of the role its nuclear weapons should now play. VOA White House Bureau Chief Correspondent Steve Herman reports.
Barack Obama knew that his successor would try to reverse many of his policies. One of them could be Obama's commitment to seeing zero nuclear weapons in the world. The United States, under its first review of nuclear policy since 2010, might also end its moratorium on nuclear weapons testing.
We have not conducted an experiment in over 20 years. And so since then, we've made some changes to our nuclear warheads, and we don't fully understand how those changes might play out in operational scenarios.
According to National Security Council officials, also on the table in the Nuclear Posture Review, recalculating the number of U.S. nuclear weapons and possibly adding new ones. All of this is being closely watched in Russia, which is believed to have a nuclear stockpile even larger than that of the United States.
Apparently, today there is no nuclear policy for the new administration. It's too early. But the problem is that the Republican Party has almost no arms controllers left.
Key Russians say they would like to have a true reset in relations, including a renewed dialogue with Washington about nuclear arms.
For the Russian side, it would, if United States is forthcoming and comes up with something interesting, it would be very difficult for Russia to say, yet we're not interested, no way.
But in some Washington circles, there remains considerable skepticism about trusting the Russians, who are accused of not complying with existing nuclear arms treaties.
So what usually happens, you know, as you well know, is the United States overcomplies with agreements while permitting Russia to have more wiggle room in order, you know, in an effort to save the agreement itself.
Arms control advocates remain hopeful the nuclear posture review will maintain a critical mass for non-proliferation.
I think over time, President Trump and his team at the Pentagon are going to recognize that we do need to continue to have verifiable arms limits with Russia. We don't want a new arms race. We don't want to open the door to new types of nuclear weapons and nuclear testing, which would have grave ramifications for the global arms reduction and nonproliferation process.
The nuclear posture review is to take 12 to 18 months to complete. That will allow enough time for a vigorous debate among administration officials and Pentagon brass. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Well, tens of thousands of Yemenis protested Sunday in the rebel-held capital Sana'a against the Saudi-led military intervention in Yemen as it marked its second anniversary. Protests organized by Shiite Houthi rebels called for an end to the conflict, which has killed more than 10,000 civilians, displaced over 3 million people, and pushed the impoverished country to the brink of famine. Human Rights Watch said in a January report that it's documented 61 apparently unlawful Saudi-led coalition airstrikes, some of which may amount to war crimes. And it urged the British and American governments to suspend arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Well, the war has pretty much ground into a stalemated conflict in recent months. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Zubair Iqbal, senior scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, if there really is any end in sight for this tragedy.
There is a very fundamental stalemate. Yemen was being used as a battleground for the hegemonic control over the Middle East between Iran and Saudi Arabia. It had turned into more of a religious factional war than anything else. Now, under these circumstances, where you have complete lack of unity on either side, there are problems. And both sides are fighting for their, quote-unquote, their primary masters. And that basically means that they're not fighting for the sake of preserving and stabilizing the region, but for their own narrow interests. Under these circumstances, United Nations efforts have not borne any fruit, number one. Number two, Saudis and the Iranians don't seem to be anywhere near agreeing to work out some sort of a deal in the region. And on top of it, there is a problem that there are Al-Qaeda, there are Islamic State, and there are other rebel groups in the port who would rather have the situation remain as is so that they can strengthen their own position and benefit from the chaos that prevails. So under those circumstances, I don't see any reason, any logical reason for the stalemate to end unless one or the other side either gets a very significant success in pushing the other one out, the enemy out, or alternatively, the sanity prevails and they start to work towards stabilizing or restoring some degree of normalcy to Yemen, which I don't see happening at this moment. And I have a feeling that the international forces are not being very helpful. And in that, I would consider that even though the United States has remained in the background, some of the U.S. efforts in the recent past and currently are not very constructive as far as bringing about peace in the region is concerned. And this attack on the Al-Qaeda center over there really didn't help. It actually created more serious problems and created more fissures in the rebel groups, which basically means that now the unified command is largely gone, and under these circumstances, local or some regional commanders are going to take over, which means that we are back to the old narrow ethnic and religious conflicts, which will be perpetuated over time.
It's interesting you mentioned the United States. There is a report now that Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is asking the White House to lift Obama-era restrictions on U.S. military support for Persian Gulf states engaged in the war against the Houthi rebels in Yemen.
And that doesn't help, because what are they fighting for? There are no significant resources, number one. Number two, there is no strategic importance as far as Yemen is concerned to fight for. Under these circumstances, any conflict of this kind, any increased support for the one or the other side will just deepen the conflict between the two sides, the Shia and the Sunni, number one, and number two, the conflict between the Saudis and the Iranians as to be the hegemonic leader in the region. So under these circumstances, instability will prevail, will get worse, and nobody will come out of it any better.
That's Zubair Iqbal, senior scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, talking to VOA's Victor Beatty. You're listening to International Edition.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame hailed the Rwanda-Israel Friendship Sunday in an address to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee Policy Conference in Washington. He was the first African head of state ever to address the pro-Israel forum that brings together thousands of activists, experts, and elected officials.
My message today is simple. Rwanda is, without question, a friend of Israel.
Kagame is credited for putting an end to the 1994 genocide in his country. In a reference to the genocide perpetrated against the Jews in Europe during World War II, he told the audience of close to 18,000 delegates that the shared history of tragedy has brought Israel and Rwanda much closer.
No tragedy is so great, so vast, that human ingenuity and resilience cannot give rise to a better future. The survival and renewal of our two nations testifies to this truth. The security of peoples who have once been targeted for extermination can never be exclusively physical. Until all ideologies which justify killing as a patriotic duty are defeated, our world is not truly safe.
AIPAC, with more than 100,000 members from across the United States, works to strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship. It opened its three-day annual conference in Washington on Sunday.
For science and technology, here's what's new.
Bicycles are a low-cost mode of transport, but vulnerable to theft. Now, a South Korean-based company is rolling out a new smart bike lock. The inconspicuous device at the axle makes your bike impossible to roll, says Siri Song with Bicycue.
Bicycue is a smart bike lock. It stays on the front wheel at all times, and it connects to your phone via Bluetooth.
The Bicycue lock can even be armed or disabled automatically, depending on how close you and your phone are to the bike. What's more, Bicycue can give the rider constant data on speed, location, temperature, distance traveled, and calories burned.
The app lets you toggle the lock and unlock function, and also it lets you to see the slope, speed, and calories burned in real time. And it's actually more accurate than a GPS tracker because it actually measures the wheel turning.
They plan to take the device to market following a crowdfunding campaign. For VOA's What's New, I'm Martin Seacrest.
Well, our next guest has an inspirational story that really reflects the American dream that anything is possible. Lizzie Brenkus and her husband John discovered after 10 years of marriage that they both had a talent for making music together. So on a whim, they released a Christmas song and accompanying video. Well, things have been taking off ever since. The song ended up charting top 30 AC. The star-studded video has over 3 million hits. Lizzie, welcome to the show. How did you guys just suddenly, after 10 years together, realize that you could make music together?
He was playing a song that he had written, and I walked by his office and just started to sing a melody across that song. He kind of did a, stop, wait, what did you just do? And I told him I sang what I heard, and he was amazed that I sang it in the correct key and that I had an interesting pacing that I added, and asked if I could do it again. And I said, sure, and I did it again. And he had forgotten that my life began as a creative soul. I was a singer, dancer. I was classically trained. It's really what I did up until I met him, and had taken some time in corporate America to make little money, and then retired to start focusing on raising the kids while they were at a young age. And we ended up discovering this 10 years into marriage, and we've been making music ever since.
But I bet you didn't expect it to be so successful so quickly.
We didn't at all. We did it for the pure love and joy of it. And in fact, the first song we wrote, which was a Christmas song, we wrote it for our family. We do creative projects as a family gift every year. And we wrote it for our family, shot a really campy, cheesy, fun video. And then when we aired it for everybody as kind of the big reveal surprise during Christmas dinner, we said, you know what? We're going to just for fun see what we can do with this song. Everybody we play it for says it's catchy. They get it stuck in their heads. And sure enough, no joke, the next year at Christmas dinner, we're listening to SiriusXM Holly, and our song is coming on during Christmas dinner 1 year later.
And you had no idea?
We didn't know that it would be picked up by Sirius, and we didn't know that it was going to do so well. It was such a fun example of when you do something that you love and you're in your groove and you just put it out there, interesting things can happen. We heard it, I think, during Thanksgiving weekend the first time on Sirius. But what we didn't know is that it was going to chart in the top 30 as the only unsigned artist on the media-based chart for adult contemporary. That was a big shocker.
It sounds like your success didn't stop there.
It didn't stop there. It kind of caught on, and we decided to create a video that had a charitable component. We partnered with Unite for Good to just spread a message of positivity and contribute toward the end of the year in that season of giving and lots of love. And we partnered with Unite for Good, invited kind of a star-studded cast to join our video, and everybody was on board, and we just had a blast with it. During that time, we were continuing to write a lot of songs, so we had about a 3.5-year creative block up until last October, and then started to release our original music. The first single from Brink of Midnight, which is the name of our band that we put together, we released right before I ran the New York Marathon in November. And ever since then, we've been releasing an original single every month, and we're continuing that into 2017 as well. Wake Up Your Soul is our most literal song, I think, for how we choose to try to live every single day. It's just one of those reminder songs that we can remind ourselves to really wake up your soul, do what you love, put your best foot forward, truly believe that when you're doing what you love, you're sharing with the world.
All right, let's listen to a bit of it.
Another sleepless night, the dark and moon, they left you to wonder what's wrong and right. These days are shaking and breaking you.
And now you guys are expanding your message into another venue.
We are. We're thrilled to, in May, on May 1st, we're launching our Brink of Midnight podcast. And what we're doing is talking about the moments that change people's lives. For us, the Brink of Midnight moment is when one chapter ends and something happens, something significant happens where everything from that point forward is different. It's changed in a positive way. And usually we find when we talk to people about these moments that it's a quiet choice, a simple everyday choice that's available to all of us at any time. And from that moment forward, your life is moving in a specific direction. So we're interviewing people, household names and not so household names, about their brink of midnight moments. We're talking to them about their own. We're talking to them about how they are a catalyst in someone else's life so that that person can have a brink of midnight moment. And then we're just curious about what is awesome in the world. We're curious about what are the positive stories that need to be told. What are those positive stories that can uplift everybody simply by listening in and hearing that anything is possible? I think when we can grasp fully the ability to do the best we can every day with what we have, when we have it, I truly believe anything is possible. And that means starting with doing what you love.
All right, nice way to end the show. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Serious human rights abuses continue under the Communist Party-led government of China, according to the latest State Department human rights report. In 2015, the Chinese government launched a crackdown against defense lawyers who take on human rights and public interest cases. Although most of the more than 300 lawyers and human rights activists detained in 2015 were released, 16 remained in pretrial detention. 4 others were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 3 years to 7.5 years in trials that lacked basic due process. Public security officials continue to harass family members of rights defenders and lawyers in retaliation for their work. Wang Yu, one of the most prominent lawyers detained during the crackdown, was released on bail after her televised confession, which was likely coerced. But she and many others remain under various restrictions, such as continuous surveillance at undisclosed locations. The Chinese government continued to tighten controls over civil society organizations. A new law placed foreign non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, under the supervision of the Ministry of Public Security, suggesting foreign NGOs were a national security threat. Although the law was not scheduled to go into effect until January 1, 2017, many foreign NGOs and their domestic partners began to curtail operations before the end of 2016. Authorities continue to censor and tightly control public discourse on the Internet and in print and other media. Official repression of the freedoms of speech, religion, movement, association, and assembly of Tibetans in the Tibet Autonomous Region and other Tibetan areas, and of Uyghurs in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, continue to exceed restrictions in other areas, both in terms of severity and scope. The government continued to impose a coercive birth limitation policy that, despite lifting one-child-per-family restrictions, denied women the right to decide the number of their children, and in some cases, officials forced women to have abortions, sometimes at advanced stages of pregnancy. The United States will be steadfast in its commitment to stand up for human rights and democracy around the world, including in China. It is not just a moral imperative, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, but it is in the best interests of the United States in making the world more stable and secure.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.